Can you hear me yet?
I can hear you, Mitch. How you doing?
Thanks for responding. I'm doing okay.
Yeah.
Good morning, everybody. I'm going to wait to see if Kat joins us. Dave will not be, but I'll give her another minute, and then we can start. Morning, Kat. Okay, we're going to start. We have everybody here that's going to be here today. So it's now 10:03. I'm going to call the Pension Committee meeting to order. This meeting is being held virtually. The public is able to attend, watching it through our website. The first item on the agenda is the approval of the February 8th, 2021 minutes. Are there any questions or concerns about those minutes? Okay, hearing none, they'll stand approved. The next item on the agenda is an update on the pension and OPEB performance. And we have Pat Wing here with Marquette Associates, and I'm going to turn it over to him.
Great. Thank you, Gina. Everybody can hear me okay?
All right. Yes.
Bear with me for 1 second as I pull up the first item on the agenda here, the quarterly report. Can everybody see my screen there?
Yes.
Yes.
Okay, terrific. So today we have a fairly light agenda. We have the quarterly performance report. We also have an update through April that we'll share with the committee. And we'll start as we normally do with the market environment. As you all well know, we like to spend maybe 8-10 minutes covering the economy, markets to provide context for how and why the funds performed the way they did, and to give some context for how and why some of the investment managers performed the way they did. But today we'll probably spend a little bit more time on the market environment, trying to really address some of Councilman Riley's questions that we saw come out about a week ago related to some questions and potential answers. And I think there's some good charts, exhibits, and language in the market environment already that speak to those. So spend a little bit more time here. Please ask questions as we run through this. And at the end of the market environment, be sure to pause and take any other further questions on what I said or any other questions that arise throughout the discussion.
Pat, could you possibly increase your volume at all?
Let's see, Councilman. How about I think it's full. Why, I try to speak a little bit louder. Is that more helpful?
Yeah, it's a little bit better. Thanks.
Okay. I'll try to speak loudly. So we start, as we always do, with the U.S. economy. And at a high level, you can see in the top left chart here, the top left bullet, that we saw real GDP growth come out in Q1 in the U.S. at a 6.5% rate. So a very strong rate. A reacceleration from what we saw in Q4, really on the back of the same themes that were driving things last year, namely strength in consumer spending and really policy support, really on the fiscal side. So, you know, admittedly, I don't know what number fiscal package we're on right now, but the support through the CARES Act beginning last year and the most recent ARP Act has been nothing short of historic. And if we think about, you know, what the government essentially is trying to do here is really provide bridge financing, pretty much, from where we were from an economic point of view last year, falling off the precipice amid the pandemic, to providing support to when we can bridge that gap and get back to hopefully a fully reopened economy and get back to our daily lives. So that policy support has been extremely important to the economic recovery. And if we look to the right here in the top right chart where you see the strike bars, those are quarterly estimates to round out 2021. And you can see here economists are projecting continued strong growth in the economy. And if these estimates come to pass, this is going to be the strongest year for economic growth since 1984. So almost three decades. So the economy is really running pretty hot right now. Now, amid that strong economy and the policy support, as we note here in the second bullet point, inflation concerns have certainly begun to bubble up to the surface. So we're seeing that from a couple different angles. Number one, a huge jump in commodity prices over the past year. We've all seen what's happened at the gas tank, certainly more recently over the past few months. But also, we have issues in the global supply chain right now. So key inputs for companies' production and the goods and services that they're providing to consumers, they're having a tough time gathering those inputs, and the prices of those inputs are increasing rather notably. Just a few short weeks ago, Ford put out in their press release for their earnings call that they had to slash production estimates for the coming year because they cannot get enough semiconductor chips to incorporate in the production of their new vehicles. So one of the things related to that that we look at to monitor potential inflationary pressures is down here below. And what this is showing is a survey of companies asking them quite simply whether they're planning to raise prices over the next few months or lower prices. And you can see that at the end of Q1, this was at a decade high in terms of more companies planning to raise prices versus companies planning to lower them. So we've seen inflation pick up a little bit. And if we think about this as far as the sort of the pipeline here moving forward, companies are expecting to pass along those input price increases along to consumers, at least as it stands over the next few months. Now, as we continue this theme of inflation and think about, you know, what other things are we looking at to monitor the potential for inflation moving forward? Another area is the TIPS market, so the Treasury Inflation Protected Securities market. So what we can do looking at that market quite simply is look at the yield on a TIPS bond, which is a real yield, an inflation adjusted yield, and subtract that from a normal Treasury bond. And the difference between the two of them gives us the market implied inflation expectation over a given time frame. So one of the things that we saw at the end of the quarter, as you can see in this first top left bullet here, is that market expectations for inflation over the next 10 years ended at the highest level since 2013, so about 8 years earlier. Now, one of the interesting dynamics as we think about market inflation or implied inflation moving forward is shown on this top right chart here. And what we're showing here again is the market expectation for inflation over the next 10 years. And we're subtracting that market's expectation over the next 5 years. And what that can tell us quite simply, as you can see, the line here is usually above zero. What it means is that if we think about it from as an accounting identity, that typically in years 1 to 5, inflation is expected to be lower than in years 6 to 10, right? Therefore, the 10-year number has historically been higher than the 5-year. But more recently, see that's flipped on its side there. So that's telling us the reverse. Right now, the market is expecting inflation to be higher over the next 5 years than the next 10. In other words, years 0 to 5 is going to see a pretty decent pickup in inflation. And then in years 6 to 10, it would come back down to hopefully more historical averages. So this is a key dynamic that we're looking at right now, because as I mentioned, 10-year expectations are rather high, but this is telling us the market expects short-term burst and then things to subside a little bit in the back half of the decade. If we see that flip, then that's going to be a key indicator looking forward that a more sustained inflationary pressures can be in the pipeline. Now, as we think about it more short term, you know, getting back to one of the questions, how bad can inflation possibly get? The most recent CPI report came out, I believe last week, it showed inflation at a high level, increasing a little north of 4%. We fully expect that in the coming months to tick higher, maybe top out in the range of 5 to 6% year over year as we continue to see rising commodity prices, the tight global supply chain filter through, and then again, companies increasing or at least attempting to increase their costs to consumers. The other thing we look at to monitor inflationary pressures, which we're not showing here, is consumer expectations. So the University of Michigan puts out a consumer sentiment report every month. And one of the things that they look at is consumer expectations for inflation over the next 1 year and over the next 5 years. That report came out last week and showed consumer expectations for inflation were at their highest level for both of those periods, again, since 2013, 2014. And we think monitoring consumer expectations is very important because there's a component to inflation that's psychological almost, where us as consumers, if we expect prices to rise, then we might pull forward some of our spending before that price increase unfolds, right? Maybe we buy that new house, that new car, that new fridge, because we expect prices to rise further in the future. But what that does is that increases demand in the short term, and therefore, it almost becomes self-fulfilling, right? If increased demand happens in the short term, then prices rise anyway. And that's sort of a feedback loop where prices rise in the short term, expectations continue that prices may continue to rise, and it's almost a self-fulfilling process, you know, prophecy, if you will. So we look at those three things, really, what companies are planning to do, what the market's telling us, and then what consumers think is going to happen when we're trying to monitor inflation. Now, the other big sort of potential, you know, as we think about dislocations that could occur here is surely the Fed wants this to play out, right? They're sort of targeting a higher level of inflation in the short term here as the economy continues to improve, but they're saying it's quote unquote transitory right now. So in the back half of this decade, again, they expect it to be more subdued, but where the market thinks the Fed is going to have to do, if we look at this bottom chart, is short-term interest rates, is that this blue line is the short-term interest rates where the Fed sets them. The light blue line is what the Fed has said that they're going to do, essentially hold rates at zero until the end of 2023. But then this green line is the futures market's projections. So what the investors think the Fed is going to have to do. And right now, they think the Fed is going to have to raise rates much sooner than what they're saying right now. And that's going to have big implications for not just asset class performance, but also the relative performance within asset classes that we saw in Q1, and I'll speak to here in just a minute. Now, from a global economic perspective, outside the US, we've continued to see an improving global economy. One of the things that has changed more recently is last year was more of a global sort of synchronous recovery, if you will, where the global economy was firing on all cylinders. But now, since we've seen, you know, sort of continued lockdowns and quarantines in some parts of the developed world, most notably in Europe and the UK, and then surging COVID cases in areas like Brazil and India, the estimates for economic growth in 2021 that you see in this bottom right chart haven't improved all that much, or just marginally, for a lot of economies and major regions outside the US. You can see the IMF had a huge upgrade for US economic growth given all the policy support, but really marginal upgrades in many other parts of the world. Now, the most notable economic region to be mindful of other than the US is obviously China, right? If we think about the two major global economic players today, you know, who drives the global economy? It's us and the Chinese. And you can see, interestingly here, they didn't get a huge upgrade to their economic growth projections. And the reason behind that, we believe, is that post the global financial crisis, China really put their foot to the gas pedal as far as policy support, right? They were one of the first economies to pass a bunch of fiscal support, monetary support to try and drive the global economic recovery post the financial crisis. This time around, they're taking a back seat. They have been very measured about some of their stimulus on the fiscal side and on the monetary side. So the script has almost been flipped here, where the US now is really the driver between stimulus and China's taken a back seat. So if we think about that, putting the pieces together, if China's going to scale back a little bit, and we talk about those inflationary pressures in the US, if China doesn't have their foot on the gas pedal, then that could sort of maybe limit those inflationary pressures from a global economic perspective. So that is a key difference in this economic recovery compared to what we saw post global financial crisis.
But Pat, I mean, the change isn't much, but you're still growing faster than we are. 8% compared to 6%.
Oh, it's very, very, very true.
So they still got their foot on the gas pedal better than ours. It's just not accelerating as much.
Well, they have their foot on the gas pedal in the sense that their economy, as they continue to shift from a more export-oriented economy to a consumer-oriented economy, and, you know, the urbanization and those themes continue to drive that higher level of growth. But what they're not doing from a policy perspective is essentially trying to augment that growth, right? They're being more measured. So if they were, you know, really driving the fiscal support, driving the monetary support, then we probably would have expected a much bigger upgrade to their economic growth. So there's certainly a big driver of global growth, as you rightly stated. But if they're going to be more measured from a policy perspective, then that could keep a lid on inflationary pressures globally relative to if they did have sort of this supercharged policy approach that we have in the US. So if we shift here, I'm sorry, was there another question? Okay. So if we shift gears now and thinking about asset class performance, and also we'll start talking about potential higher inflation adjustments and maybe market dislocations here moving forward and things to think about as well. So as far as markets were concerned, you can see at a high level the returns, this chart on the right here. The green bars are the quarterly numbers. The purple bars are the one-year numbers. And at first glance, you look at the green bars for equities, and it doesn't look all that great, but it's really a scaling issue, right? These one-year returns were so historic that since they're in the 60% range, it almost makes the 6% return in Q1 for U.S. equities look smaller than it actually was. But as you all well know, a 6% quarterly return is a very strong number. So within the U.S., we saw investors really still price in this continued hopeful economic recovery, and in sympathy with that, a continued rebound in corporate earnings. And we saw a very, very strong Q1 earnings season from U.S. companies, again, rising in sympathy with that economic recovery. You look in the international and emerging market equities, as I mentioned earlier, those sort of COVID issues, whether it be quarantines or rising cases, really weighed on international and emerging market equities, at least relative to the U.S. during the quarter, so they underperformed. However, the real action during the quarter was in the bond market. So as we saw inflation concerns sort of bubble up to the surface, we did also see a big jump in interest rates. And when rates go up, as you all well know, bond prices go down. So this return for the bond market was one of the worst quarterly returns in quite some time. Now, it's important to note that this return is for the broad aggregate bond index. So it's inclusive of all maturities of investment grade bonds, whether they be treasuries, agencies, mortgage-backed securities, investment grade corporates, but it has a longer duration or interest rate sensitivity than the fixed income within the funds. The fixed income within the pension and the OPEB has a much lower duration, so less interest rate sensitivity. So when we look to those returns just shortly, the fixed income in the funds was down in the order of closer to 2% relative to the broad fixed income market of 3.5%. So having that lower duration, lower interest rate sensitivity was helpful relative to the broad market. The last thing I'll mention, that the data is not available on this page, but core real estate, we've continued to see stabilization in that market. And Clarion, the Lion Property Fund, the real estate manager, was up about 2% during the quarter. Now, if we take a look under the hood in the U.S. equity markets, again, you can see this top right chart here showing the rolling one-year returns for the broad Wilshire 5000 index. You can see at the end of March, it was north of 62%. So again, a historic rebound from a year ago at the depths of the pandemic and the best rolling one-year return since the early 80s. Now, if we think about that one-year return, it was really a tale of two halves. So in Q2 and Q3 last year, what was driving the market, given rates were still a little bit low, was large cap stocks, was those large growth stocks like the Facebooks, the Amazons, Apples, Microsofts, Googles, those sorts of names, which was a little atypical because at the beginning of an economic recovery, we would expect interest rates to rise, which would be more of a boon for, say, value type stocks, small cap stocks relative to those ones that were outperforming in Q2 and Q3 of last year. But we did see that turn. So in Q4, now again in Q1, as we noted in the second bullet point, what we saw is more value areas outperform. So places like energy, financials, we saw small caps do better than large caps. So again, in a rising interest rate environment, which didn't happen as quickly as we expected, once it did continue to unfold or did start to unfold, then it was positive for the areas where we have some tilts in the funds, namely to the value stocks, to the small cap stocks, which do better when rates rise. And we have a chart on this next page here at the bottom of page 14 that shows exactly that. So if you look at the bottom here, what this is showing is in the orange is the 10-year treasury yield over the past 3 years. And the blue line is the relative performance between value and growth. So when that blue line is decreasing, it means growth is outperforming value and vice versa. But you can see even pre-pandemic and then amid the pandemic and just after the pandemic, rates were declining or are reasonably stable. So growth had continued to outperform value. But as rates bottomed in Q4 and started to tick up in Q1, that script was flipped. We saw value come back into favor and small caps come back into favor relative to those growth stocks, which is what we would have expected to happen. Now, finally, to wrap this up, and again, I want to summarize some of the answers to the questions as we think about moving forward. The top chart here just gives you a sense of what happened with interest rates during the quarter for treasuries. So you can see this dotted line in the middle where rates across the curve at the end of the year. the blue line is where they ended in the end of March. You could see not much movement in the short-term rates, given the Fed has things still anchored at zero. However, in the intermediate term and those longer-term bonds, rates ticked up rather notably. So a couple of things to comment on this. Number one, obviously, we saw what that did to bond prices during the quarter. And also, number two, even though they moved up, they still remain exceptionally low relative to historical averages. So fixed income, as we look ahead, had a big negative return in Q1, but over the intermediate term, since rates are still low, we can continue to expect sort of subdued returns from the fixed income market. Now, if we think about rates and, you know, potential dislocations, there's really two things I think to consider, and they're really both related to the amount of debt being issued and leverage in the system right now. And we're seeing, as we all well know, a big pickup in debt on the federal or public sector, but also what I think is it's sort of flying under the radar is the corporate sector has also become more leveraged as they've issued debt at very, very low rates and have used it to reinvest back into their business, but also very notably to buy back their stock. And if rates do increase from a federal perspective or a, you know, the public sector perspective, when we think about a budget, right, you have to use more of your budget to pay interest, that's an unproductive use of money, just paying interest. So moving forward, if rates rise and the interest that the federal government rises that they have to pay on their debt, then more and more on that, it's going to be have to use for unproductive uses, things like interest expense, as opposed to say infrastructure or education, things that have a long-term benefit. The other angle is from the corporate sector. So I saw a research report a couple months ago that had stated if interest rates rose to more normalized levels, say soar in this 4 to 5, 6% range, then the amount of interest expense that S&P 500 companies would then have to pay would cut their earnings by about a quarter. Because right now their interest expense is so exceptionally low, it's not eating all that much into profits. But if rates rise and they continue to roll over that debt or issue new debt, that could have a big implication for S&P 500 earnings and therefore returns from the equity market. The other thing that we monitor as far as dislocations are concerned is really credit or credit spreads, which we're showing in the bottom chart. We're big believers that of the saying that credit leads and equity follows. If you remember the global financial crisis, we had some dislocations or hiccup in the credit markets really in early 2007 between a couple of hedge funds failing, in early 2008 between Bear Stearns failing. And that was sort of the canary in the coal mine. And we saw credit risk increase rather notably while the equity markets remained a little sanguine. And then ultimately, equity markets followed and went in the tank after the credit markets already sort of gave us the signal that that could occur. Subsequent to that, credit markets bottomed before equity markets. So high yield spreads actually bottomed at the end of 2008, whereas equities didn't bottom till about a quarter later. So again, if we measure, you know, the embedded credit risk within high yield, right now spreads or the additional yield for those bonds over treasuries is very, very low. If this were to tick up, that would be another flag to take a look under the hood. What's driving that increased credit concerns? Is it a longer term concern? And can that filter into the equity markets? So to wrap up with some of the summary, as far as inflation is concerned, I talked about the three things that we monitor as far as inflation is concerned, as far as the TIPS market, consumer expectations, company surveys. As far as inflation getting, how, you know, how bad it might be, I do think we're going to see a further increase here in the next couple of months and couple of quarters. From a longer term perspective, I think we can expect inflation higher than the Fed's target of 2% of what we saw over the past couple of decades, maybe more in the 2.5 or even 3% range, which will have big implications for markets. Now, related to some of the other questions, you know, what can we do about it? And I think that we can segment it into two different buckets, right? What can we do about it based on the tools that we have right now, right? The asset classes, what's in the portfolio. So if inflation looks like it's going to pick up further, what are we going to do? Number one, probably most clearly and obviously, lower the duration within the fixed income portfolio, right? Decrease that interest rate sensitivity of the bonds that we still hold. Number two, augment probably those small cap and value tilts, as we saw earlier on with rates increasing, that really drove relative outperformance from those areas, and we would expect that continue if rates continue to rise. And number three, remember, we have real estate within the funds right now. It's sort of an inflation-sensitive type asset, and we expect infrastructure to be called either later this year, hopefully, or early next year. So that will increase the allocation of sort of inflation-sensitive assets within the funds themselves. Now, as far as other adjustments or, say, tools not in the current toolkit to possibly think about, number one, from an equity perspective, if we do see interest rates and inflation pick up notably, that would probably be more beneficial to international equities relative to the U.S., really for two reasons. Number one, the U.S. market is largely comprised of, again, large cap and growth stocks. Those five companies I talked about earlier comprise about 20% of the U.S. market. They're large cap growth companies, and we saw how they woefully underperformed in Q1 when rates started to tick up. Compare that to international equities, where it's a much more diversified sort of basket, where those large cap growth stocks don't comprise a huge part of that index. We would expect international equities to take it, say, less on the chin relative to the U.S. The second thing related to that is if we do see inflation pick up rather notably, then you can reasonably expect the dollar to weaken. And when you invest in international equities, those companies are generating cash flow and earnings in their local currencies. And then us as U.S. investors gets translated back to dollars. So when the dollar weakens, those local currencies can buy more dollars, and therefore it's additive to returns. The second other angle that we've begun to talk with clients about as far as, you know, additional tools in the toolkit is an area called private credit. So think about this as similar to private real estate and private infrastructure, but it's investments in essentially making loans to private companies. So think about, us as consumers having to go to the bank for a mortgage, right? We don't issue debt to public markets and investors aren't trading it. Smaller companies who don't access public markets go to maybe a bank or an investment manager to provide those loans. And why it can be helpful in an inflationary environment or a rising rate environment is, number one, the yields on those loans are typically higher than those available in the public markets because, again, it's a private sort of investment, so there's this typical premium. But the more important part is that it's floating rate debt, so there's no interest rate sensitivity. So again, you know, going back to the mortgage analogy, say you have an adjustable rate mortgage where the rate sets every year, your interest payments that you have to make to the bank are going to fluctuate based on rates. And if rates go up, your rate's going to reset and you have to pay more money to the lender or the bank. Be the same idea here, where these rates reset not annually, but actually quarterly. So there's little to no interest rate sensitivity because if rates rise one quarter, the next quarter that interest rate resets. So the borrower pays more to the lender, again, the bank or the investment manager making those loans. So those are two other sort of areas not currently in the toolkit that we could possibly think about moving forward. And I like to circle back to that as we think about the next meeting towards the end of the presentation. But with all that said, let me pause for a second. I know that was a lot to digest. Happy to answer any other questions or any comments related to that discussion. Okay. So let's... All right, so let's hop into the results for the two funds, and then we will wrap up with the April updates. So you can see here on page 21 of the report some high-level observations. We'll run through these numbers here in just a second on the next page. But you can see the return for the pension during the quarter was 3.4% net of fees versus the benchmark of 3.2%. So what helped the fund during the quarter was basically what I talked about about earlier, U.S. and non-U.S. equity structure, again, having those tilts to small cap, having those tilts to value, which helped when rates rose and they outperformed. Also, Clarion, the real estate managers I mentioned, outperformed their benchmark. But then on the negative side, so what detracted a little bit was the active global equity managers. And just to revisit a comment I made at the last meeting around Schroders, was one of the global managers in the pension where we're, you know, quite frankly, a little disappointed in their performance. And we ultimately did make a change actually in early May. But during the quarter itself, the global equity managers in aggregate were a little bit behind their benchmark. Looking ahead, you can see down here, I'll talk more about those changes that we made in the pension. And then also the JP Morgan Capital call, as I mentioned, hopefully coming later this year or in Q1 next year. So high level information on the next page, you know, this is pretty much, you know, think about it, the executive summary page tells us all the key information at a high level. So if we look at the first quarter, the pension began at about $138.2 million, and there was an investment gain of about $4.6 million. So the fund itself grew by about, you know, $4.65 million during the quarter. You see the returns here, we'll skip over this for just a second and look at it in just the next page. But before doing that, what I like to mention always is the asset allocation, two quick key things. Number one, every asset class is within the range as set forth in the IPS. So you can see yes here across the board. And number two, at the end of the quarter, we did have a slight overweight to equities to the tune of about 1.5 percentage points, which was helpful in April, where we'll see with the update, because equities continued to outperform other asset classes in April. Now, as far as some of the changes during the quarter, I mentioned them slightly, but just to illustrate them, number one, you can see here in the net cash flow column, basically all the changes that occurred during the quarter. So I'd like to speak to a couple at a high level. Number one here, as I mentioned, we did rebalance a little bit towards the end of the quarters as equities continued to ramp up a little higher. So you see a $1 million withdrawal out of the Vanguard Small Cap Value Fund. Within international markets, we did make a slight tweak, adding an a dedicated emerging markets index fund. This was in early March. And as we think about, you know, the global economic outlook, if we continue to see a red hot global economy, again, typically those more volatile or cyclical areas tend to do better, and emerging markets fit that bill. So that was a change we made with that expectation. And if inflation also continues to percolate up, the emerging markets had more commodity type exposure, say the energy and other agricultural commodities relative to international markets. So that should be helpful as well if interest rates and inflation continue to head in that direction. And then the other key change we made, you can see towards the bottom here, negative $1.65 million outflow in, out of the high yield bond manager. Like I showed earlier on, those spreads have come way down. So that was an area that was very, very cheap a year ago. And as things have continued to improve, it's become overvalued. So we want to get, you know, paid for the risks that we're taking. And right now that's an area that has more credit risk than regular fixed income markets. So we just took some chips off the table there and rebalanced the rest back into the fixed income. Now, from a peer perspective, the rankings rather relative to other public defined benefit funds, you can see here focusing on the quarter, the 3.4% return was better than the median. So again, a lot of the headwinds that we talked about last year in Q2 and Q3, which were a detractor, again, being a little early, rotating into value stocks and growth stocks with that expectation that rates were gonna rise, proved detrimental. But then in Q4, now here in Q1, with that unfolding and having those tilts, again, was helpful to the benchmark and then relative to the peer group as well.
Pat, I got a question on the previous slide.
Yes, which slide?
The previous slide. So we took money out of the Chartwell short duration high yield because it became too pricey, right?
Yes.
Did we make money?
On the high yield?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. So we, let me see if I can pull up an exhibit here that would be helpful.
We didn't lose it back as rates went up, is what I'm saying.
No. So we think about what we did with high yield. When we saw spreads just blow out last year, we added that allocation in really mid-March and then again in April. So you can see the high yield returns here over that 1 year period was actually up about 24%. So adding that money earlier on was helpful. But then during the quarter, you can see here, it was only up about 0.8%. So it still did better than fixed income in Q1. But as it continued to outperform sort of regular fixed income, it's just become more and more overvalued. So we still have a small, you know, nominal allocation. But given this, you know, huge return over the past year, we felt like we're just not getting paid enough for taking that risk. So it worked. But now looking ahead, you know, there's 0% chance we're going to see this type of return from high yield over the next 12 months.
Great.
So if we look at some of the manager returns here, we'll walk through this in some granularity before we switch to the OPEB. You can see at the top here, the total equity composite in brown. So that is the weighted average return of all the equity managers. In US, global, and non-US, you can see slightly ahead of the benchmark. That was really driven in the US and non-US. So you can see US here about a percentage point ahead. And that was driven by the dedicated allocation of small cap value here. We just using a cheap Vanguard passive fund, which was up 17% relative to that broad market Russell 3 at 6.3%. So having that tilt there was helpful within US equities. You look at the global equity composite, as I mentioned, that was a drag. The managers in aggregate underperformed, largely again due to Schroders. So they're a manager that is a quality type focus manager, but also with value stocks. So if we think about the quarter, you know, they really should have had a headwind and a tailwind almost offset each other, right? As I talked about, more cyclical, volatile areas did better. So that would have been a headwind for them because of their quality focus. However, value did so much better than growth. So since they have a tilt towards value, that should have been a tailwind. But what we saw when you put the pieces together, that again, they were behind their benchmark. So when we saw the quarterly number came out, we made the decision, we're going to change the structure here, but we don't want to sell low. In other words, we don't want to sell low after a period of underperformance. Let's monitor this over the next couple of months. And if they can outperform a little bit, then that's the time to make that change. And we saw that in April and in early May. So we did move forward with that change there. In the non-US equity space, as I mentioned, in aggregate, when you put those pieces together ahead of that benchmark, again, largely due to having a dedicated international value manager here, Hartford Schroders. So you can see not only did value itself outperform the broad market, but Hartford Schroders outperformed because, again, they're value, but they also have an allocation or a higher than benchmark allocation to small and mid-cap stocks. So that proved helpful for them. As far as real estate is concerned, you can see Clarion again up 2%. So we continue to see stabilization in that market ahead of the benchmark and the peer group pretty much across all time periods. And then to my point earlier about the fixed income in aggregate, more or less in line with the benchmark, but having that lower duration or less interest rate sensitivity in aggregate only down about 2% relative to that broad market benchmark of 3.5%. So let me pause for a second before we shift gears quickly to the OPEB to see if there are any other questions or comments from the committee. Okay. So we'll run through the OPEB and a little bit more quickly, and then we'll switch gears and look at the April updates. So we'll look at those high-level observations, the data here in just a minute. As far as the attribution, what worked, what didn't work, similar story as to the pension. And then looking ahead again, we expect that infrastructure call to come hopefully towards the end of this year. So again, the executive summary page here, you can see the fund began with about $54.85 million at the beginning of the year. Had an investment gain just over $2 million. So the fund itself grew by about $2 million during the quarter. As far as the returns themselves, we'll again look at them in just a minute versus the peers. But the one thing I did want to note, you can see here the OPEB was up 3.7 versus 3.4 for the pension. And that was largely due to the global equity structure, again, because Schroders is a manager that was unique to the pension whereas the OPAD has a little bit different structure. But as we sit here today, they're in line with each other after the changes that we made. From asset allocation, similar story. Everything is within the range. And we ended the quarter with about, again, a 1.5 percentage point overweight to equities, which proved helpful in April, which we'll see in just a few minutes. As far as the changes, again, a similar story to the pension, right? Took some chips off the table in the equity market, even though we ended the quarter with a little bit of an overweight. Added the emerging markets equity index to complement the index that's there. And then as far as the rebalancing is concerned, moving that money not into high yield, the high yield manager here, Lord Abbott, but back to Wilmington Trust fixed income, the more core conservative fixed income manager within the OPEP Trust. So from a pure perspective, as you might expect, when we look at the quarterly return down here at the bottom of the table, where the pension was 3.4, or good for top 41%, the OPEB at 3.7 was good for almost top quartile. So in a given quarter, the range can be so incredibly tight that even just 0.3 percentage points can result in a pretty drastic difference in a relative ranking perspective, but certainly top quartile. Again, good strong showing for the quarter, given those tilts that we put in place and were admittedly too early on last year have begun to pay off here in 2021. So the last thing for the OPEB I wanted to point out, just to get at the difference between the pension and the OPEB's returns, and is in this global equity space. So recall a second ago I mentioned that the global equity composite for the pension was up 3.9. For the OPEB, it was 4.7. So we have basically a 0.8 percentage point difference. And with global equities comprising about 24% of the portfolio, that pretty much explains all the difference between the two funds. And again, predominantly driven by the difference in the manager here. So with the pension, it was Schroders Global Quality. Here it's Alliance Bernstein Global Core. And you can see they did much better than Schroders during the quarter. But again, as we stand here today, we made that change out of Schroders pretty much about 2 weeks ago, and are now using this specific structure with these specific managers and allocations within the within the pension plan, so it mirrors the OPEB plan.
Pat, I know we don't like to see negatives, and we got a negative next to Artisan Global Opportunities, but I believe it has rebounded well just in the past month, month and a half, I guess. So,
yes, you're spot on. So this is a manager that's a global growth manager. So when we think about it, that's a really good question. You know, I glossed over it a bit because we have, you know, four managers here, but they're all doing different things. So MFS is more of a lower volatility type manager. Alliance Bernstein is a core manager, so kind of down the middle of value growth. Artisans are global growth manager, and then Dodge & Cox is the global value manager. So it's not just the individual pieces, but how they fit together. But, you know, your point is well taken. They were behind the benchmark during the quarter and growth underperformed, but they have rebounded in 2021 and certainly more recently because in April, growth stocks did come back into favor a little bit. Are there any more comments or questions about the report before we move on to the update and then wrap up with just a couple other quick comments? Okay. Bear with me, please, for one quick second as I share the updates. Do it here. Nope, hold on. One quick second, that's the same report. There we go. Okay, here we go. My apologies. So here we have performance through April. So we'll look at the pension first. For the month, the pension was up 3.4% ahead of the benchmark at 3.2. As far as themes are concerned, even though growth sort of had a little bit of a comeback relative to value in the month, what was helpful was the equity overweight that I mentioned. You could see equities up sort of in the 5% range. So having more money in equities relative to the policy was helpful. Within U.S. equities, even though small value you can see here was behind the broad market benchmark, the one active manager that we use was well north of their benchmark. So that more than offset the allocation of small value at the total composite level. Now, the global equity composite, you can see here a shift from the underperformance in Q1 to some outperformance, notably because Schroders turned the corner a little bit. You can see about 0.3 percentage points ahead of their benchmark for the quarter. And then in early May, they were about a percentage point ahead in the first week. So that's when we pulled the trigger again, trying to not sell at the bottom, but sell high on at least on a relative basis, and then implementing that new structure. So when we look at the pieces again, now year to date up 6.9% relative to the index of 6.5. And as we get closer here to the end of the fiscal year, we're not showing it on this page, but for the pension, the return is around 22.6% through the end of April. So well, well north of that assumed rate of return. So when you get your next actuarial valuation report in the back half of this year, we're going to see some positive implications of that, given that return for the fiscal year 21 is well north of the assumed rate of return of 7%. Now for the OPEB fund, comments are largely the same. You can see the performance in line with the pension, slightly ahead of that benchmark. Given the slightly better showing in Q1, it's up 7.3 versus 6.5. So again, a little higher than the pension. And fiscal year to date, the OPEB up 23.3 through the end of April. So a similar story as far as what we can expect from an actuarial perspective when that valuation comes out for fiscal 21 later this year. So it should have positive implications from a funded ratio perspective and any contribution or budgetary perspective when we get those numbers later this year. So with that said, comments or questions about the update before, I just want to make a few final comments or to round back to what I talked about earlier on. Okay. So as we think about moving forward here, as I mentioned, you know, with the potential dislocations, inflationary concerns, you know, what we would do given the toolkit now as far as duration, value growth, and those sorts of things, you know, it could be an opportunity, particularly given the valuation, the actuarial valuation is coming down the pike here in 6 months or so, to take another look at asset allocation. You know, is there any appetite to look at the relative allocations between U.S. and non-U.S., given the comments I made earlier, or any appetite maybe to just have an education on private credit, the asset class I mentioned earlier on, which could also be helpful in an inflationary environment. If so, we could put together some materials to share at the August meeting. Certainly no decision would have to be made at that time, but just education for the committee and maybe help frame up that discussion as we think about moving forward.
And what was that class, Pat? Say it again.
I'm sorry, Mr. Rogers.
Which asset class are you want to consider?
So it would be so twofold, the relative allocations between U.S. and non-U.S. And then the other asset class is called private credit. And it works very similarly to the private infrastructure and the private real estate from an investment vehicle perspective within that's within the funds right now.
So I do have a question. What I heard you lay out is a possible response to a rising inflation environment is shorter durations on bonds, which makes sense, small caps and international, and then potentially adding private credit into the mix. So, and Gina knows what I'm going to say probably, you know, I'm always concerned about risk. And how does this impact the overall, you know, risk of the portfolio? So I feel like I keep moving out that you know, range farther and farther, and I'm a little concerned about it.
Sure. So if we take a step back for a second, Councilman, when we did the asset allocation and talking about infrastructure, you know, how we, it's important not just you know, what we add, but where it comes from, as you well know. So when that was added, we sourced it from equities and sourced it from fixed income. So to sort of keep the risk profile in line. So to the extent we think about these other items, the key answer or what will lead us to answer your comment would be, if they are added, how is it sourced? So I can't answer that without really looking at the numbers and saying, well, if we think about private credit, do we want to maybe draw that down from regular fixed income, or maybe a combination of fixed income and equities like we did with infrastructure? So I think what could be helpful is, again, maybe just a quick education on the asset class itself, and then putting together a risk and return profile, which would answer your question and show you those details. And related to that, you know, I talked a little bit about the actuarial evaluation report coming up, I think in November, Gina, is that?
Yeah, it would be November.
November. So that can be also a very helpful reference point, because as I don't have to tell you all, the funds are extremely well funded right now. So to the extent that we want to keep the asset allocation the same or the risk profile the same, in theory, you could also consider, you know, maybe lowering the assumed rate of return, because then we don't have to shoot for a 7% rate of return. Now, obviously that has budgetary implications, and I'm not privy to, you know, the numbers that would have an impact on. But if we want to stay conservative, just given the issues around fixed income and the outlook there, then that could be a possible lever to pull, right? Stay with the conservative mix we have now, but maybe lower that assumed rate of return, because then we can stay conservative and continue this lower volatility type of approach, which would then hopefully have lower volatility relative to that target rate of return. So that's another sort of lever to think about. So maybe the discussion in August, we have it based on what I outlaid, but then wait for the actual evaluation report before, you know, deciding how and if to move forward. I think that could certainly be helpful and additive to this conversation.
Yeah,
that sounds like an internal conversation there. I doubt we're going to change that, but anyway. If we get into a season of, you know, it looks like you're projecting growth, which is good, and some inflation over the next 5 years. What if we got into a scenario based on some of the administration's policies that end up putting us in a place of stagflation, where we're not seeing growth, but we're still seeing inflation? I see that as a real possibility.
I would agree that the probability of that outcome has increased, certainly without a doubt. So we think about stagflation, right? It's important to really sort of know the history, right? And maybe understand what's different. So when I say know the history, thinking about a historical analog being the 70s, right? So what worked during the 70s? Well, unfortunately, not equities. They did okay in nominal terms, but inflation adjusted, they got hit hard. Fixed income got hit very, very hard. What did well was more things like commodities, which we typically do not recommend because of the volatility of those of that asset class, and natural resource type equities. So, you know, energy focused type stocks, materials, industrials. So in that environment, getting back to, you know, thinking about the equity structure, then again, we got to think about shifting more towards those value type areas, the energy type areas, the materials type areas that held up relatively well relative to the broad market. And then just to round out, you know, the portfolio itself, if we have 5% in sort of inflation insurance now through real estate, that's moving up to 10 once we get infrastructure into the mix, hopefully again over the next 6 or 7 months here. So that'll give us more inflation insurance, if you will, within the portfolio. So that will help protection. But, you know, if we go into a stagflationary environment, it without sort of making drastic, and we would argue probably not, you know, too aggressive changes of adding a dedicated allocation to things like commodities or precious metals, which, you know, if you get the timing wrong on that, you get destroyed. You know, thinking about other sorts of asset classes, again, like real estate, infrastructure, maybe upping those allocations slightly if we're headed into that environment. I think that could make a lot of sense.
I think I noticed in there some tips, funds. Have you got any kind of white paper on tips that you could send me and if the others are interested?
Yeah, I believe so. I can make a note and be happy to send that across.
I haven't found, and maybe I haven't done enough research, but I haven't found where they really worked when we came out of the Great Recession. And so I'm not as optimistic moving forward here.
Yeah, I think, no, that's a great point. You know, what happened when in the Great Recession was TIPS are a little bit more illiquid than treasuries. So they actually got, even though they're government issued bonds, they got hammered in 2008, where new sort of nominal treasuries were actually your insurance there, and TIPS got hammered. But as we stand here today, TIPS have done well relative to normal treasury bonds because those inflation expectations have risen so dramatically. But now, since that's happened already over the past couple of months, they are much less attractive than they were even a short time ago. So we think they could make sense here and there, but right now they're pretty, I would argue, fully valued at a minimum and probably a little overvalued.
And do we have much in them then?
And not a ton. Where we get exposure to that is through the active manager, Wilmington Trust. We'll have a nominal allocation here from time to time. And then some of the short-term managers like Lord Abbott, who's in the pension fund and now in the OPEB fund, they'll make nominal sort of allocations from time to time here and there. So there is some exposure, but it's not
a much
stretch of the imagination. No.
Okay.
Any other questions or comments or feedback about perhaps the direction for the August meeting of providing a little bit more education and numbers to around the risk and return profile? Is that something the committee is interested in just taking a look at in August?
So just comments that I have, I think it might be a meeting too early. I'd rather hear from the actuary first to see if we need to add it. I'm telling you that what you're suggesting makes me nervous. I'm risk adverse, just like Councilman Riley is.
Sure.
And loans to companies just sounds very risky. With a floating rate, sounds good on our end, but the person that we're giving the debt to is going to have to react to that increased rate as well. So concern. I looked at where we went with internationals. We started at 2% in 2017, and we're all the way up to 15% allocation. So we have increased internationals a lot, substantially, is the way I look at it. I'm not so sure I'm ready. The rest of the committee might be, but I'd rather wait to hear from the actuary, see where we are with the assumed rate of return. Are we at a good at a good number with 7%, or do we need to adjust like we do every year? We usually do it at the actuary, and then we do it at the February meeting. Does anybody have any, the committee good with that approach?
I am. I'm good with that.
Good. Okay. Yeah, I think we just have it. And then maybe at that time, Pat, you've talked to other groups, and they've maybe added it to the portfolio, or you can fill us in also how your other clients have reacted.
Sure. That sounds great. Happy to proceed. So at the August meeting, then we will have basically a performance update and quarterly performance report that we had today.
Yeah, that would be great.
Okay, great.
Okay. Anybody have any other questions for Pat? Okay, hearing none. Thank you, Pat. Appreciate it.
Thank you all.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Okay, and the last item is just adjourning. So do you have a motion to adjourn?
So moved.
Okay, I have a motion and a second.
Second.
A second for Ms. Brewington. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All right, we are adjourned. Thank you.
Have a good weekend.
Take care.
Thanks.